The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Wonderful to be in your company. The Money Show brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP, financial services provider. Just been crunching some numbers, and it's really interesting to see South Africa's tax collection rate increasing by an average compound annual growth rate of 9.9% over the last 30 years. How has that happened? If you look at South Africa's economic growth rate, we averaged between 1994 and 2023 just 2.3%, 2.38% per year over that time. That was the average. We peaked in the fourth quarter of 2006, a quarterly growth number of 7%. That year we grew around 5% in total for the whole year. Lots of numbers here this evening. But the point I'm trying to make is that we've had an exceptionally low average growth rate over that period of time. It's been very, very disappointing. The first decade and a bit of South Africa's democracy from 1994 to 2008 went well. We've discussed this many times. The wind was in our sails. Interest rates were low. Global rates were low. There was a huge amount of ambition for South Africa. There was a huge amount of optimism for South Africa. And everyone was incredibly hopeful that this incredible miracle was going to be pulled off against all expectations. The Mbeki Mandela miracle was going to be pulled off. Then, of course, it went to hell in a handbasket in the global financial crisis. No fault of South Africa's, but how failed to recover from the global financial crisis when the rest of the world took off is our own fault. Plenty of own goals. In the last 10 years, we've hardly had a year of 1% growth. Yet during that time, South African Revenue Service has grown at a compound annual growth rate of 9.9% in tax revenues. 1994, total tax revenues of 114 billion rand. That's how much SARS collected over the last 4 days to bring the tax take for this financial year, which ended at the end of February, to more than 2 trillion rand. The SARS Commissioner, Edward Kiesvetter, standing by.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
I've
always urged you to be wary of the doomsday merchants who will warn with absolute authority that South Africa is on the edge of a fiscal cliff. And because of a deteriorating economy and all of the risks that we know we face, there is absolutely no way that tax collections can continue to grow. Yeah, of course, the economy is in trouble. We're a million miles away from where we could and should be. Yes, we spend too much and we earn way below our potential. But it's the persistent doomsday narrative that's incredibly unhelpful. Well, SARS, over the last financial year, collected more than 2 trillion rand in revenue. About 12% of that was via driving into parts of the tax base that either haven't been tapped or through extensive court actions against those who like to sidestep the law. The SARS Commissioner, Edward Kiesvetter, recently accepted an extension to his contract as boss of the Revenue Service. He joins us this evening. And I guess, Commissioner, there's plenty of revenue in South Africa that's not adequately accounted for and declared. That explains part of this 2 trillion rand tax take, right?
Bruce, you should replace me because you've hit the nail on the nail on the head. In fact, we consistently have been saying that if we have a more efficient SARS that can administer its laws professionally, independent, without fear and favor, we don't have to increase tax rates. Quickly, to just share with you, we have 300 billion rand of debt that's not disputed and uncollected. This year, we collected 91 billion of that debt. In terms of tax gap, every study shows that there's between 200 and 300 billion under-recovered. Then we add to that the fraud against SARS, the refund system, have become everyone's piggy bank. This year, we have prevented fraudulent refunds from flowing out of over 100 billion rand. So you're absolutely right. If we do our work well, we haven't reached the peak of our revenue collection. Our current compliance levels are still only 63, 64%.
Yeah, and that's deeply frustrating, of course, for those of us who are compliant and for those of us who do obey the law. Keith Engel, who I'm sure you're familiar with, talking today about saying rather than raising taxes for the compliant, it's about nailing those who operate without paying their fair share. And of course, true compliance requires a couple of things. It requires a belief that taxes are going to where they should go, that they're being spent the way they should be, and South Africa fails in both of those. Plus a sense, of course, of consequences that if you're non-compliant, you do get the kitchen sink thrown at you. You made the mention, and you often make mention, and people are still skeptical about it, that nobody is above the law, that nobody is above the tax law, yet it is a widely held belief in South African society that some of us are more equal than others when it comes in this regard, with all the Skinner, all the scandals, all of the evidence at the Nugent Commission, at the SARS Commission, of course, the same thing, and at the Zondo Commission. There is so much evidence there of a gross abuse of the South African system that it seems hard to believe that we're not making better progress in this fight against those who are not tax compliant.
Bruce, our frustration, we share your frustration. So to give you an idea, just in this year, we have currently done 870 criminal investigations. And of that, we've handed 294 of that to the NPA. And we have had successful convictions, but we need to make progress. Of the 85 cases in court, we've had 81 successful convictions. And I can tell you now that about a third of that is just related to VAT and income tax fraud. In terms of our syndicated tax and customs crime, there we have 147 investigations and have completed 160 already. The amount of revenue that we have collected just from that activity has this year been 6.6 billion. But again, we are dependent on the Hawks, we are dependent on the NPA, so that we can have these perpetrators ultimately behind bars. And that's the frustration we still have.
Yeah, it's deeply frustrating. And of course, in the process, and I get lots of complaints, and some of them I forward on to your people, from people who say, look, I mean, SARS is making my life hell. I'm compliant year in and year out. I file each and every single thing year in and year out. I either get audited, get lots of questions about something which I regard as routine and constantly do my bit in order to be compliant. Yet I feel like I am being persecuted in SARS attempts to be rigorous in its processes. And there is a question of balance, I suppose, that somehow has to be achieved.
Yes, and I can say without any fear of contradiction that I think that whilst we still drop the ball, we still have frustrations which we own up to, I think we have the balance just about right. And that is borne out by the fact that we have significantly used data science to improve the experience for 4 million taxpayers. By the way, a 97% acceptance rate of the work we do using only third-party data and machine learning. They have a seamless experience. Those who do find that they may be selected, some of them, despite what they may say, do sail close to the line in terms of not declaring all the income or masking some of it. And that's what the fraud risk detection picks up. That's where the 95 billion ban comes from. And so we will always fall on our sword when we are either guilty of collusion with a taxpayer, we have fired employees who have been caught with unprofessional behavior. When we drop the service ball, we'll pick that up. But our service in the last 5 years have increased from 55% to almost 80%. Just our service improvement, and that's measured against very objective criteria as stated in the service charter. And so I personally put myself in the line of fire for taxpayers to report directly to me. And when there's a service issue, we roll up our sleeves and we get involved. So I must say that at the moment, despite the fact that we will not declare victory, we are striking the balance just about right.
Yeah, you talk about compound annual growth rate in tax collections of 9.9%. Now, I mean, that's Bernie Madoff-style growth, and not that I'm equating it at all, but it is exceptional growth in revenue collection from $114 billion in 1994, which I think was the total tax take that year. You collected that in the last 4 days. Now, look, the rand isn't worth what it was in 1994. There's been depreciation, but it gives you a sense of scale in terms of the growth of revenue collection versus economic growth. Please explain this anomaly to me, where we've seen economic growth of 2.38% on average since 1994, but 9.9% compound annual growth rate in tax collection. There's a big gap there between what we see in the economy and what SARS is achieving.
So there's a number of indicators we can use. The first is tax to GDP ratio. Our tax to GDP ratio has been in about the ballpark where most countries would want to be. The minister, both ministers of finance have said they want to trend that lower, but we have been between 25 and 28%. This year we are just under 25%. So that suggests that we are not extracting more tax than what we should from the economy. That's the first point. The second point is that countries like Norway, some of the Nordic countries, have compliance levels of 90% plus. South Africa's compliance level is in the mid-60s, which says that the headroom we have, the low-hanging fruit, consistently will come from the level of non-compliance. And it is therefore the growing efficiency with which SARS has been administered, say for the state capture years, that has consistently delivered a growth ahead of the economic growth. And that's purely just from efficiency gains through the revenue administration over the last 26 years.
Edward Gizveta, the SARS Commissioner this evening. Thank you, Commissioner, very much indeed. More than 2 trillion rand in tax revenue, 12% of that. Pick a number, via getting people who don't pay their taxes or dodge their taxes or think that they can pull one over SARS coming through that mechanism. Yes, the rest of us are inconvenienced if you face an audit and you think, just hold on a second, but I've been waiting for this refund, for example. So yeah, it's an astonishing track record in a low growth economy. 2.3% average growth since 1994. The first half of the democracy, very effective, very well managed, very good growth rates, peaking at about 7%, as best I can tell it, in about 2006. And then the wheels came off spectacularly. And the guy who led the wheel coming off celebration are now objecting to his being excluded from the electoral roll. I wish I could have a skin half as thick.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Just to amplify the point that SARS is collecting against a backdrop of a struggling economy, there's a thing called the Purchasing Managers Index in South Africa, sponsored by APSA. Anything above the number 50 suggests that there's confidence that people are ordering new supplies, that they are confident about growth into the future. Anything below 50 suggests that there's negativity. In March, the number once again dropping below 50. We started the year strong, but confidence is beginning once again to ebb. Selo Sikele is an economist at APSA Group. APSA sponsors the PMI, of course. How important are interest rate expectations, Selo, when it comes to our confidence in investing in the future? 6 months ago, rate cuts were already fully enforced by now. They're not. And I'm guessing that is what is sapping some of that confidence.
Good evening to you and your listeners. So I want to say that when you think of interest rates boost cyclical demand. And, you know, when they come down, demand tends to rise. And when they increase, it tends to dampen interest rates. But the main part that determines how strong or weak economic activity in any sector is the pace of structural reforms. So that's what really moves the needle for any sector in terms of economic activity, to be honest.
Okay, so, I mean, one can one compare PMI on a like-for-like basis around the world? I look at India, for example. By our standard, it's massively confident. They have got a PMI number of 63. Brazil, for example, along with Nigeria and Singapore, have seen massive improvements in PMI over the last 12 months. The Eurozone has gone from positive to negative. Are all PMI numbers calculated in the same sort of way? Do we get a good sense from around the world as to who is feeling good and who's not feeling good?
The simple answer is yes. So there's a standard way of calculating PMIs. So if you want to compare like for like, then we're going to talk about the manufacturing PMI in this instance, right? So that tends to be made up of five sub-indices, which is business activity, new sales orders, employment, suppliers' performance, as well as the level of inventories. So the short answer to a long story is that, yes, they are comparable.
Okay, so how do we get to be a little bit more like Nigeria, like Singapore, like Brazil, and a little less like Europe and other countries which are feeling decidedly browbeaten at the moment, all falling below 50?
So, look, each and every country has its own, domestic issues, right? Before you even talk about international factors that affect everybody more or less the same. So, if you look, for example, in the US, right, the PMIs there are a bit strong because you're starting to see economic activity re-accelerating. And then if you look at the EU and in China, for example, which is very important for us in terms of exports, there the PMIs are a bit weak, and it's definitely that, right? Stories that has to do with their domestic market.
Selo, thank you very much indeed. Selo Sekele, economist at APSA Group. Yeah, the PMI number in itself, a little bit dull, a little bit dry, but you delve into it just a little deeper and you get a very clear sense that there are parts of the world that are feeling considerably more confident about the future than we are. Among those places, India also going into you think our election cycle is complicated. Jeez, India takes them a month to vote and get the results because there are 1.3 billion people across a vast landscape that need to be serviced. By our standards, massively confident. We've seen a rebound in confidence for likes of Nigeria and Singapore as well. But as far as South Africa concerns, we bumble about at 50. Some months we're up, some months we're down. No big reason for us to be feeling particularly effervescent about the future right now.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Norman McKechnie we go. Norman, of course, is a portfolio manager at Momentum Asset Management. And Norman, I was just looking at the gold price and the stratospheric rise in the gold price, a commodity of which we sadly are almost out of in South Africa right now. But it still provides us with a really interesting barometer as to global sentiment. And I think it was Karen Richards on the platform formerly known as Twitter last week that said gold will often send you a signal about something that becomes obvious months into the future. And the gold price has been rallying like, a Dakar rally driver who's been given an extra boost of high-octane fuel. It's been nothing short of extraordinary. $2,255 an ounce or nearly 1.4 million rand for an iPhone-sized kilogram of this metal, which is supposedly the sort of indicator of the future. What is your sense of what is happening in the gold price?
Bruce, thanks. I think if you look at what sort of happened in the gold price, I mean, what it normally used to do, it used to track the interest rates, the inverse of what we call the TIPS, which was basically an inflation-linked bond, which and whatever rate that was quoted at. And whenever that went down, it moved with the inverse. Whenever that was low, gold price was high. That totally broke down about 3 years ago, and then the gold price subsequently moved away. And what we've had is central bank buying of gold. And I think a lot of that, certainly in the last 2 years, has been related to Russia, Ukraine, where Russia after that invasion, had the confiscation of its assets, and obviously a lot of those in dollars, etc. And I think there's been a move from the likes of Russia, China, Turkey, and others to buy gold in their central bank as part of their central bank holdings. So we've seen big buying of that, and I think you know, I've been quite surprised at the move that we've had of late. It sort of moved up literally $150, and we're now on the second leg. When it gets $2,300, that's the second leg of $150 up. We saw a similar pattern, I think, in 2022, where it shot up. Obviously, it started at a lower base. But I think it runs out of steam in the short term, probably pulls back, and then if they continue to buy and interest rates come off, we probably see the gold price going higher in due course.
It's astonishing, isn't it? And a great pity that we mined it all in the 1970s and the 1980s, predominantly. We've still got gold players on the market, of course, and their share prices have been responding appropriately to the enormous demand for that commodity. Other commodities, not nearly as in demand. Of course, we've seen our platinum shares come off very sharply. However, our base metal commodities have been a little bit more robust, perhaps, than those that produce commodities that glitter, for want of a better term.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, from a PGM point of view, I think the story has been there that I think there were a lot of inventories that were built up, particularly in the likes of rhodium, which was a lot higher than what it was now. In fact, the platinum miners actually made more money out of rhodium 2 years ago than they did out of platinum. If one looks at what's actually happened, clearly the other commodities have done well. I think there's a shortage of copper, and certainly I think the outlook over the next 5-7 years is extremely positive for copper. In terms of there's no new mines coming through, one, and then two, obviously there's a lot of copper that's absorbed into electric vehicles, and whether electric vehicles grow at the pace that people are sort of projecting, who knows? But you've also got to put in the infrastructure. And that's going to require a lot of copper. So that's done well. And then in the short term, iron ore with the sort of rebuild of property in China or the restart there, that's obviously been underpinned. But I think that could wane in time.
Thank you, Norman McKechnie. Norman is a portfolio manager at Momentum Asset Managers. On a day where markets around the world have been pretty negative, we did see London's FTSE 100 briefly go beyond 8,000 to its highest level ever, off the back of a rally in oil producers. There are many of those listed in London, but the rest of the world very much in the doldrums today, very negative. And we saw a retracing in the value of the dollar. That pushed up the value of the rand a tiny little bit. The all-share index on the JSE lost just over 100 points, nothing too serious there. Most of the running, however, happening in those gold and platinum shares. After Eyewitness News, which is happening in just a moment, we're going to be, of course, reflecting on how to make money when you're dead. It's a light-hearted take on one of South Africa's most prolific authors. That is, at least until Dion Meyer got involved. Wilbur Smith, 3 years after his death, he's still writing books, believe it or not. After Mbali Dlamini now with Eyewitness News at 6:30.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I'm just standing by for Kevin Conroy Scott, who is living his best Wilbur Smith life. He is in Colombia, as I understand it. Kevin Conroy Scott is the agent of the late Wilbur Smith. More on that in just a moment. Usually at the summer day, I'll tell you what's coming up on the next Money Show, but I don't know what's coming up on the next Money Show because I am taking a couple of days off with my family to go and explore a new place. We thought that would be a little bit of fun. Somebody who had no shortage of exploration of new spaces was Wilbur Smith. And there was a moment in 2020 during the pandemic when my first book, The Upside of Down, was selling more copies than Wilbur Smith was selling. Just for a moment. Just for a moment. Around that time, I was with my family in one of those COVID breaks at the Cape Town Fishmonger at Steenberg. And Wilbur Smith and his wife were at another table. And I wish I'd gone up to introduce myself and do a humble brag, or just at least a nya, 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 I'm selling more books than you are today. But I didn't. And that's a pity. My English teacher was something of a reprobate in his youth, I suspect, and he would tell us stories of Wilbur Smith at university. Lots of stories about the women who would stay over in his room and what Wilbur Smith would say to his fellow hallmates as they stuck their head out the door in the morning to watch said visitors go down the corridors to the loo and things like that. And yes, that wasn't usually very polite, but certainly Wilbur Smith was something of a legend. So I am sorry that I missed out on that opportunity. My big question was, I came across my social media feeds the other day, and I've been highly cognizant of the fact that Wilbur Smith's name is appearing on brand new books that are being published fairly regularly with his name as the author, 3 years after his death. It's hard enough to write while you're alive, after all. So, let's talk to his agent, Kevin Conroy-Scott, the co-founder of Tibor Jones & Associates, on the line to us from Colombia this evening. Kevin, I don't know how many books Wilbur Smith did write in his lifetime, but he certainly sold many, many millions of copies.
Yes, hi, Bruce. Yeah, he has, we're over 140 million copies and counting across over 50 books now. So he's had quite a remarkable 100? Career.
140 million copies
over 50 books. 20 million in Italy. Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, he's a fantastic writer whose fans loved him, collected him in hardback. One of his fans even was had his coffin filled with Wilbur's books as burial. That's the kind of loyalty and love he kind of instills in his fans. It's a really remarkable legacy.
Because toward the end of his life, I noticed that there were books along the lines of his titles and themes with him listed as the author, but then he had co-authors. And I'm seeing this model pop up with many prolific popular writers are using it. You'll see James Patterson in cahoots with another writer, for example.
Right. Yes. Yeah, but when I started working at Wilbur's then agent, before becoming Wilbur's agent, I said to Wilbur, I said, there's a tension in your work because your fans collect you in hardback, but the academic world sees you as a writer of popular entertainment. Although his fans see him as the kind of Hemingway of his time and taken very seriously. And indeed, much of Africa knows their history through reading Wilbur's books. And I said, Wilbur, in order to keep your legacy going long beyond your life, you should really consider working with co-authors. And at first he said, over my dead body. And then he came around to the idea. Because what happened is he didn't like the idea of it at all, because he was very much his own man. But what happened is that when his fam now shifted from writing onto Facebook, all his fans started saying, well, what about this Courtney saga? What about this Ballantine story? What about Taitha in ancient Egypt? What about Hector Cross? And he said, I don't have the time to write all this. The only way to give my fans what they want is to create a story vault and to get and to work with co-authors. And so we did that. Wilbur worked very hard in his 80s to create a story vault and then hand-pick co-authors to work with. And a number of the books he finished before he passed away. He was very involved, very much in control of his legacy, and left that as a legacy to his fans and also to his wife, who has inherited his estate. So it was something that we were really super meticulous about.
So the look and the feel and the themes are very much Wilbur Smith, although he would have no doubt have been very selective into as to whom with whom he would have collaborated in that process. They would have to have a sense of the man.
Yes, absolutely. And the themes and, Wilbur chose the storylines, and then he worked with the co-authors to adapt those. And also, it's quite rigorous what you can and can't do in a Wilbur Smith book, because those are very well defined. They're his body of work. So, there's a number of things, there's a number of things that you can and can't do. I can't mention the secret sauce on the radio, but it's super specific to Wilbur. And I wouldn't even call it a formula. I would say it's a way of life in terms of the way he saw the world, in terms of his experiences growing up on his father's ranch and what was then Northern Rhodesia.
This can probably work for a while, but not in perpetuity. I was talking to a friend who's a big fan of Lee Child's Jack Reacher series, and he's observed that Lee Child's son is now writing some of the books or co-writing some of the books. And he said, it's a small thing, but the tone has changed. It's a little bit more woke, perhaps. It's a little bit more 21st century. And there are a couple of things you can't accuse Wilbur Smith of, and one is being woke and one is being very 21st century, certainly after about 2010. he was very much of an era.
Yeah, we're aware of that. I mean, we have a new book which deals with the Zulu Wars, and so we have racial sensitivity readings done for that, because, the last thing we do is offend anyone. But also we want to stay true to Wilbur's spirit. He's got a book coming out in the autumn, which is about the Siege of Mafeking, And yeah, there are certain things that come up that could be said a certain way 30 or 40 years ago and be said differently now. It doesn't change what's in the books and doesn't change the theme to which Wilbur loved, you know. So, yeah, and, you know, I think it's co-authors are a necessary part because, you know, you publish or perish. And you are right. I mean, Wilbur's fans will always be there. You know, some of them are passing away. And so a big part of what we're doing is we're creating a production company to go out and make films because we need to let new people who don't know about Wilbur know about Wilbur's work and also satisfy the fans that have always wanted to see his work up on the silver screen. So that's a big part of what we're doing right now.
I think it was the Courtney series in East Africa around Assegai and others. It was sort of Elizabethan era, maybe slightly later, piracy on the high seas. It was real gangbuster stuff, and it does lend itself to massive biopics. I remember once chatting to a prolific South African artist by the name of Errol Boyle, and he was doing very well toward the end of his life, but he was churning out paintings. And I said to him, why are you doing so many? And he said, well, you know, once the marketing machine dies, then the sales collapse. And I've noticed that, you know, the sales achieved by Errol Boyle paintings now are considerably lower than when he was alive. I wonder what's happening to the number of books that are being sold in Wilbur's name to this day.
Yeah, so there is a little bit of, you know, decline in terms of, you know, because, you know, some of Wilbur's contemporaries, the Hoa fans, are no longer with us. And, you know, they've aged out of fans. And, you know, it's difficult to find new fans unless you have new things to go out to market with. So, but we still sell over a million books a year around the world. So we're still in very, very good health. The fans are very happy. If you look on Wilbur's Facebook, you've got over 3 million fans there on Facebook, and they're very vocal and very protective. They love the work. They love to know that Wilbur left these stories for them so they could satisfy their curiosity about his body of work.
And, of course, should the films work, and there's no reason why they shouldn't, that could very well reinvigorate interest then in the historical titles.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a huge thing. If you look at what happened with George R. R. Martin, he was kind of a little-known TV writer who wrote a book called Game of Thrones, which is kind of a medieval fantasy. And, yeah, that completely transformed his fortunes, as well as those of HBO and a lot of other people. And that's the thing, that Wilbur's work is huge. It's epic. It's always the biggest and the best. And, you know, it's not a cheap thing to do. But it's a beautiful thing to do. And I think the thing is, I think South Africa and Africa as a continent is ready to have those stories told about. I think Hollywood's ready for it. I don't think they were 5 years ago, but I think they're now ready. They've exhausted the Marvel franchises. They've exhausted all these different stories to tell about America. I think they now want to learn about where humans come from, which is the story of Africa. And the story of how it was colonized and all this kind of...
When do you anticipate the first movie will be out? Have you identified which book it will be from? Can you tell us yet?
Right now, we're focusing on Blue Horizon, which is at the beginning of the first Courtney trilogy, which is a prequel to When Lion Feeds. It's a Prey, Blue Horizon, and Monsoon. And that's something that's kind of in development. We've got a really great team who are responsible for remaking East of Eden. The new Netflix series with Florence Pugh, they're involved, and they're a fantastic team. So you've got people out in Hollywood who understand what they call Wilbur's soap and scope.
Kevin Conroy Scott, thank you so much for joining us this evening, all the way from Colombia, where he's traveling at the moment, co-founder of Tibor & Associates. He is the late Wilbur Smith's agent. That's how you make money after you die. Astonishing, really.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
We might not have any IKEA stores in South Africa, but the foundation, linked to the world's biggest furniture retailer, may just help accelerate the adoption of electric vehicles here and in other emerging markets. There's a global initiative to drive adoption, and it's getting a $100 million grant to help developing countries bypass the internal combustion engine. Money being used to support lobbying efforts, campaigning for the EV transition in Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia in an initiative that they're calling the Leapfrogging Partnership. Now, this could help get 43 gigatons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere by 2050. That'll be useful, including in South Africa. Co-founder of Everlectric is Ndiya Magadagela, who is the chief executive of Everlectric. This is a big deal, I think, Ndiya, in terms of the amount of money that is available. I'm sure there will be strings attached, but could very well help drive our energy transition.
No, for sure. Good evening, Bruce, and to your listeners. This is big news, really. I mean, this grant funding is said to be available to help with charging infrastructure and the lack of EV-friendly policies, you know, to just create better market conditions. And this is a much welcome grant to us who are, you know, practicing in this industry.
There are lots of reasons for a very slow uptake of EVs. Mostly, I guess, that we can't be sure that there'll be any power coming out of the plug when we want to plug in our EVs. That's gradually being addressed, and I'm sure you're more au fait with that than most of us. But and that's got to be probably the biggest constraint, plus, of course, the huge import duties and the taxes associated with EVs in this market.
Exactly that. So indeed, the slow pace of adoption has been due to the high cost of EVs, or rather, let's say the perceived high cost of EVs, because like you rightfully say, Bruce, these are currently being being addressed. If you look at South Africa right now, there are actually just under 30 models that have been made available by different manufacturers. And these are ranging in prices from your entry level to, you know, to the into the millions. But having said that, the high cost is really due to the import duties that are levied on these vehicles. And we really believe that with the reduction of these and local manufacture of electric vehicles, the prices can come down, which will drive adoption for sure.
Okay. I mean, are we making progress? We've seen, finally, regulation come out in terms of the ability of the industry to start investing in producing electric vehicles in South Africa. I wish we were 10 years ahead of where we are, but we're not.
Sure.
We've got a very effective building program of internal combustion engine cars, but unless we transform that sector very, very quickly, we're going to be sitting on a dead industry. Are you seeing evidence that we are making progress?
I mean, look, recently we've heard, you know, a broad statement of government policy through the EV white paper being announced in South Africa. In the last budget speech, we've heard the minister make mention of a 150% investment allowance to encourage local manufacture of EV. I do believe, and I agree with you, Bruce, that we've lagged behind and we've been slow in this. But, you know, if you look at a few years ago and compare it to where we are now, I think there is some movement, and if we give it time, we might also just, you know, pace up and be faster. But certainly we are seeing the uptake of EVs, you know, increasing in South Africa with all of these issues. Where we play in the B2B market, where we lease electric vehicles to the commercial sector, we are seeing a huge uptake because of the efficiencies, because of the cost savings, and also because, you know, we get to tick the E in ESG. So there is definitely an uptake. And some of these developments with government policy will really just help to propel the industry further.
Ndiya, thank you very much indeed for chatting to us this evening. Ndiya Magadagela, who is the chief executive and co-founder of Everlytic. $100 million available for accelerating the adoption of electric vehicles in emerging markets. I think it's a good thing. Do you think it's a good thing? I think it's a good thing. After Eyewitness News, something that lots of people think is a good thing, but I think is a terrible thing. And that is the idea that we should get ourselves a good benign dictator, somebody who's got our best interests at heart, somebody who can make big decisions, somebody who's not constrained by politics, fear, favor, or, I don't know, personal interest. Is it a good idea? I don't think so. But somebody I know who thinks it may be a good idea, or is at least tempted by the idea, joins us for our Signals feature after Eyewitness News. Mbali Sanibai.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Bronwyn Williams in just a moment, the trend translator and future finance specialist at Flux Trends. will join us, and followed by Dr. Rutendo Hwindingwi, the founding director of Tribe Africa Advisory and author of Rumble in the Jungle Reloaded. I was approached the other day for a speaking engagement to say, and the person who approached me very kindly, and I was very grateful, said, oh, by the way, just so that you understand the high profile guest that we invite, last speaker was Dr. Rutendo Hwindingwi. And I went, I'm not worthy. If Rutendo is the standard, I truly am not worthy. But he's going to join us in just a bit. And then from Galileo Capital, as always, on a Tuesday night, Warren Ingram is going to be telling us why we need to learn to be good losers. And it's hard, you know. Yeah, I suppose if you're a Bafana supporter, you're kind of used to it. Why am I fighting? It's my last day before holiday. Why am I fighting with you? No, but you've got to learn to be a good loser. And that is a pivotal factor when it comes to investing. Because if you're not a good loser, you are going to be severely compromised in terms of your ability to invest for the long term. So that is what is on our agenda this evening.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Welcome to The Money Show tonight. Incredibly alluring to look at the creation of modern Singapore and to the enormous global success that has become from a muddy colonial outpost to one of the most sought-after business locations in the world, the leadership of its founder, Lee Kuan Yew. And it makes it very, very attractive. You look at Singapore, you look at its success, you look at the business that it is attracting, lots of companies leaving China, lots of companies leaving Hong Kong and domiciling themselves in Singapore. A bunch of South African companies are headquartering themselves there too. And it suggests that the way that countries need to succeed may very well be in the form of a benevolent dictatorship. Someone at the top who's got the best interests of everyone at heart, who doesn't tolerate dissent, and through their example and their wisdom creates a kind of utopia that we'd all like to live and thrive in. I wonder if it's that simple. Bronwyn Williams, as I mentioned, is the trend translator and future finance specialist at Flux Trends. And you contacted me out of the blue the other day, Bronwyn, to say, this is what I'm thinking about. Should we be talking about benevolent dictators in a year of 60 enormous elections in the world's biggest democracies all happening and coinciding in the same year? And I thought to myself, it's a good idea. So what are you thinking?
Yeah, exactly. So this like follows on from a paper that I did that was looking at scenarios for the future of South Africa post-election. Many people who work as futurists like myself like to do. And it sort of came about from a couple of studies that we had looked at through our work that was showing that even prior to COVID, so in other words, when times were perhaps a little bit easier and a little bit, or felt a little bit more certain than they do now, a full 62% of South Africans were open to the idea to give up elections in exchange for a non-elected government that is actually able to provide jobs, housing, and security. And this, of course, got me wondering what that number will be today. Probably higher than that. That's kind of consistent with studies that have gone on across the world. And again, we do quite a lot of work looking at Generation Z or the under 30 demographic globally. And we see a much higher propensity among young people to be open to ideas of authoritarianism, perhaps because they haven't actually had to experience it themselves. And sometimes the grass looks greener on the other side, but also because of the sort of sense that people have at the moment that the world that we have, particularly the capitalist globalist world that we are living in right now, is a bit of a zero-sum game. In other words, no matter how hard you try, or however much you might like to live in a meritocracy, you can't really get ahead in playing the game when there's so many people sort of cheating at the rules, if you want to put it that way, or when the strong seem to win and the weak don't. People are open to these ideas. And I was wondering perhaps if that's something that we need to consider in the South African context, when we also look at youth apathy voter figures. And it was something that sort of came through quite strongly in the research that we did, that perhaps we do need to be concerned about these sorts of anti-democratic trends and slides. But I have to say that this research that I did was put together before the MK party threw its hat into the ring. I think that too kind of spoke to some of the potential scenarios that we drew out of the research that we looked at, Jan.
It's frightening, isn't it? You have no idea what the alternative is and what its consequences are, but you prefer it because the current system doesn't serve your expectations. I don't want to say it doesn't serve your needs or desires. It doesn't serve your expectations.
It isn't working.
It is working, and it's working better than any other system that we've experimented with so far. It doesn't make it perfect. It doesn't make it unfallible.
Mm.
But certainly any bit of research that you do into the risk of the benign dictator, the benevolent dictator, surely warns you that it's got to be a worse option, or not.
Yeah, exactly. But when you say that it is working, I think we have to sort of put a bit of a proviso there that it's not working as well as it used to. If you want to look at differences in outcomes by different generational cohorts, again, something that we do that we perhaps get criticized on. And one of the other things that we picked up in this report that I thought was a really interesting idea for South African context in particular, in fact, several South African academics have written very eloquently and very extensively on the subject, is this concept of weighted or protracted adolescence that young people find themselves in when they are not able to achieve the markers of adulthood that previous generations have. So in global context, and we can start globally and then move locally, this would be things like not being able to buy a house for your family, even if you have a quote-unquote good job. I don't know if you're so familiar with the fact that in America right now, there's a growing trend across many different states where churches and shopping centers are opening up their parking lots for people to park their cars in overnight to live in, because affording even to rent property is now out of the reach of people, even people who have good jobs, jobs like teachers and nurses. In the local context, of course, we're not even achieving the basic markers of adulthood that include even having a job. We know what our youth unemployment rates are. And as long as you are dependent on your family, on your parents, or on your state, and not actually able to become economically independent, to take control of your future, to take control of your life, you are kind of stuck in the sort of Peter Panhood of being effectively a child, even though you are a grown-up. You are treated as a child by your society. And this sort of sense of not being able to achieve those markers of adulthood, of course, gets us to question whether the societies that worked for my generation, your generation certainly, and for the generations of many of your listeners too, is not working in the same way, perhaps because we're having to share power and resources across more generations, thanks to our lifespans being longer. That's one sort of hypothesis. There's also the sense that over time, democracy tends in a direction towards, as we know, towards sort of a more the medium rather than necessarily the excellence of society. And we don't actually know what the long game of democracy is. If it's long game equilibrium steady, we don't know, because it's a fairly new thing in society. And when young people no longer believe in the system, the system is no longer working.
The ancient Greeks were exploring this concept of democracy, and it seemed like a good idea. Yes, their democratic model was different to ours, as was the Roman model, as is every model. Mm. What strikes me as particularly concerning here, Roman, is not that people are going, well, this doesn't work, so let's go to a benign dictator, benevolent dictator. Mm. It's that they're uncreative and are not thinking more broadly about a system that would be more useful, inclusive. We tend to go for what's appealing, easy, and looks like a quick fix, which, as we all know, no matter what you do anywhere in the world, that is never a solution to a structural problem. You can't fix this thing easily. I recall having a conversation with our good friend, the late Poyan Igwala, who was beginning to raise this as an issue in the early days of the Ramaphosa administration, and expressing his discontent about the fact that he didn't see the president being able to make the sort of progress he seemed to want to make, because he was constrained by the market and by the party.
I feel that frustration.
At the same time, you give that power to the wrong guy. And we've had the wrong guy who had the power and fortunately not the capacity to use it to the extent that it could have been used, because that could have been disastrous had it been more intellectually driven. Then it would have been quite, I think, abysmal for all of us. And so the trends are certainly headed that way. The only way, I suppose, to avert the trend is to make the system work better or re-engineer the system in a way that is more inclusive, that gives your and my kids a better stake in the future? Because that's very real as parents too.
Absolutely. I mean, you get to the point, right? So when it comes to democracy and these ideas, the ideal is definitely worth preserving. Perhaps the flawed version that we have of it in reality is worth challenging. And in fact, it's almost imperative that we challenge the version or the particularly man-made rules around the democracies that we have before these ideas get thrown out wholesale, baby and bathwater, by future generations who have not experienced, like I said right at the beginning, what the alternative really is, the best of the bad ideas that we have at the moment is actually the best idea. People don't understand that if they haven't experienced the other side of it. So we need to be open to challenging the differences between democracy in theory and democracy in practice if we do want to preserve the ideals for future generations. And I agree with you absolutely that we have to. We don't really have a choice. However, the other sort of point in the paper that I think is worth drawing attention to here is around not just the systems of democracy or the versions of democracy that we have that don't appear to be working for perhaps impatient or perhaps stuck in weighted younger generations. There's also this really massive elephant in the room. And that is actually the fact that we have a lack of elephant in the room. We have an incredible lack of leadership in the world right now, particularly wise and benevolent leadership. I think many of your listeners would be very hard-pressed to point out wise and wonderful leaders globally, let alone locally. Elections have devolved to the point that we're essentially choosing the least worst option on the menu, or the least less appetizing option on the menu, rather than choosing something that we choose to be actually, or think to be actually delicious and worth actually voting for. So we tend to use our votes almost to vote against the other side's option rather than voting for someone we truly believe in. And that was one of the central sort of takeaways that we had here from this research. And that was the idea that we are lacking leadership that's worth looking up to. And there's also an important distinction to be made there, the difference between a populist leader that promises you what you want, like you alluded to earlier, right? The difference between populism and pragmatism, a guy that promises you what you want, and the guy that actually, or the woman or the person that actually has a vision that they want to bring you along towards, an actual leader. I think that that's the real danger that we have around democracy, this idea of preserving systems that don't work rather than the ideals behind it, which is this idea of governance by the government for the government, which is such a noble aspiration. We instead can tend to be sort of hung up on our own particular constitutional laws, which differ from country to country and through time, like you said, and can and should be challenged, and the lack of actual leaders to vote for. And we're not short of people to vote against, but we do seem to be short of people to really vote for, to get behind, people who don't just criticize the other parties, but actually have a plan and a purpose for the voters to actually want to vote for.
Gotcha.
I think that those are the sorts of things we really got to look at if we want to preserve these ideals going forward.
Bronwyn Williams, thank you. Thought-provoking as always. Bronwyn Williams on the allure of the benevolent dictator. She, of course, is a trend translator and future finance specialist at Flux Trends.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
And it's brought to you by SAA, celebrating 90 years, connecting dreams, bridging continents and soaring higher. In studio, Dr. Rutendo Huindingwi, the founding director of Tribe Africa Advisory, the author of Rumble in the Jungle, Reloaded. Talk to me about digital trade. It's this wonderful idea that services, certainly, can pass over the internet borderlessly. How advanced are we as a continent in terms of our digital trade?
Good evening, Bruce, and always good to chat to you. And you're spot on the mark in terms of digital trade. I mean, according to the World Trade Organization, in layman's terms, which is you and I, Bruce, is digital trade is defined as items ordered or delivered digitally, so that you can see how specific and how accurate that is. But what it really just means in big terms, that it complicates the platform in terms of the digital geography, which has always been the challenge. So when you look from an Africa perspective, or let's start from a global perspective, the digital economy is probably, in terms of the trade that happens digitally, is plus or minus $3.8 trillion globally. And Africa's contribution to that, Bruce, is plus or minus 1%, 0.9%. I'm just being smart and rounding off to the nearest 1%. So what a small speck in the bigger play of things. But the upside of that is that digital trade from an Africa perspective or from a global perspective over the last 15 years has grown plus or minus 40%. And from an African perspective, it has grown plus or minus 91%, Bruce. So there's definitely an impact with regards to digital trade and the impact it's making from an Africa perspective. The question is, what are the opportunities and the restrictions around that?
Yeah, and it is a difficult one, isn't it? Because you do want to encourage the free flow of ideas. You want to encourage the free flow of information, even the free flow of technologies and digital currencies, for example. And we just look at the exponential growth that the likes of MTN are seeing in their business across the African continent in terms of digital currency. We've seen digital currency flow across borders in ways that, you know, in the old days you would have to send a man with a letter or a person with a letter to a house with some cash stuffed in an envelope. Nowadays things are moving really quickly, and the digital economy covers all of these things, and we really do, I suppose, need some sort of pan-African understanding as to how it works for everybody better for the long term.
No, you're right, Bruce. And I think the challenge that is there, and that's where the challenge lies, because from a digital trade perspective, I mean, digital trade is really take a lot on steroids, to put it in the simplest of words. It's take a lot on steroids across borders. That's what really it is. The challenge is that once you get into the digital space, and that's where this whole new protocol by the African Trade Commission that has been put together with regards to enhancing digital trade on the continent, the opportunity or the challenge that is there is once you go into the digital space and there's movements of digital information with regards to people's personal information, commercial information, then there's the whole issue of privacy, there's the whole issue of governance. It becomes a complicated world because even from a global perspective, there's no specific law that governs the movement of private data and information and privacy across borders from a perspective. So on one side, it creates an opportunity with regards to digital trade, but it also creates a complexity because there's still a lot of gray areas with around corporate governance around digital trade globally. The other challenge that is there is once you open up economically from a digital perspective, there's the challenge with regards to one man's meat is another man's poison. So if, you know, once you start allowing international players to play in the digital space in Africa perspective, what does it mean for the smaller digital players with the African continent? So there's all this risk and opportunity around it, and there's a lot of wavering in terms of what are the pros and cons. I think it's a space to watch in the coming years, but definitely it is going to impact Africa, albeit we're 1% of digital trade contribution from a global perspective.
And we either engage it, we either embrace it, or we get left behind by it. And we don't get the leapfrog we hope that digital would give us. Talking about cocoa, we've spoken about it a lot on the radio in the last couple of months. As cocoa prices, of course, have skyrocketed around the world, the economies in which the cocoa is grown aren't necessarily going to get the benefit of those high prices.
Yeah, it's an interesting turn of events. So, I mean, we all know, it's known to most people that 60% of the world's cocoa is produced by two West African countries, which is namely Ivory Coast as well as Ghana. Now, both of these economies, in terms of producing cocoa due to adverse weather conditions as well as disease, have had a decline in cocoa production. I think Ghana is down by 30% year on year. Now, funny enough, even in this kind of situation, and obviously that's created a demand from a demand and supply economic perspective, that's created a demand of cocoa globally. But even from this perspective, the price or the president of Ivory Coast has increased their cost price of cocoa from like by 36% from $1.8 per unit to like $2.46, which is, whether it's a good idea or bad idea, we're still to see. But the challenge in all of this is that usually, you know, as I said, West Africa is the leader in cocoa production. But what has happened is that the South Americans or Latin America, specifically Ecuador, is now producing significant cocoa and coming to the point of competing with Ghana. I think last year it was expected this year Ghana was going to produce about 500,000 tons and Ecuador is probably going to produce 460,000 tons of cocoa. So it puts to question, is the idea of increasing the cost of cocoa by West Africa the right idea assuming that South America is also now becoming a competitor on the global market, and that's yet to be seen.
And then, finally, and I love this story out of Nigeria, and real practical steps being taken to providing young people with the skills they need for the future we can't see. And we love talking in South Africa about, oh, we just need to create jobs. We're going to create jobs, and then people will have jobs, and then everyone will calm down and everyone will be happy. Well, nonsense, clearly not. It's about preparing people for a future that they can choose for themselves. And I don't know how we do that. Has Nigeria got a blueprint we can look at?
They seem to have, and I'm just highlighting a report given by Adesina, who's one of my favorite guys on the African continent, the current president of African Development Bank. As you know, by 2050, Africa is going to have like 25% of the world's the world is going to have 25% of the world's population by 2050 is going to be somebody's African, either you or me, Bruce. But one of the key things that they've done in terms of upskilling, especially the young people, is they've injected plus or minus $80 million. This is the African Development Bank. $80 million in terms of skilling an Ekiti state. The state is called Ekiti. They've got 36 of them in Nigeria. I was actually involved in one of the states in a similar project called Imo State. But they've injected $80 million in terms of skilling people and across Nigeria. For the Ekiti state, they've specifically injected $14 million and they've committed to this on an annual basis. And not only are they skilling people, but they're also going to produce 26,000 jobs. So for me, that has always been the challenge, you know, to skill people, especially with the focus on digital skilling, which is the project, but more importantly, in creating jobs. And they've got similar projects in Cabo Verde or Cape Verde, as well as Senegal. And I think there's another project also along the lines that has been invested by the African Development Bank in Nigeria again, called the IDIC program. And that's $618 million over a series of years to contribute like $64 billion towards the economic growth. So all of this is good, but then the question is
the money show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram
seems to be purely focusing on Nigeria, even though it's the biggest
show. Warren Ingram is a certified financial planner. He is an executive director at Galileo Capital, and he's also got a fabulous new book out.
Absolutely,
Rutendo. Thank you, Dr. Rutendo Quindi, the founding director at Tribe Africa Advisory. You know what, Warren? We will get to what you want to talk about, but I must talk about your fabulous cover. Which you published today, which is all about your new book, which you've collaborated with a psychologist on, because it is, to coin a phrase, about the psychology of money, I guess, and about the way we behave with money. It's stuff we talk about all the time on the radio, but I really love the fact that you have got a highly accessible, bright yellow cover, small changes for big results, how to improve your finances one step at a time with you and a man with an unpronounceable surname.
Dr. Mark Rogashnik is his name, Bruce.
Dr. Mark Rogashnik. How simple compared to what's written on the cover of the book. Rogashnik, I can say that. Good.
Thank you. It's you know, when I wrote this book, it was kind of, you know, still in coming out of the depths of COVID. And what I realized was, you know, this is in one form or another book number four. And what's always bothered me about writing about money is we get so many questions around financial literacy. People are forever telling me that we should focus more on financial literacy. We should do more education of youngsters at school and university. And the increase in financial literacy will solve all problems. And not saying that financial literacy doesn't have a huge role to play, but what bothers me is that there is an enormous amount of information that's available for free, this show being one great example, where people can get an incredible amount of information about how to manage money, how money works, how investments work, and yet through the years and decades and even centuries, we see people, you know, kind of repeating patterns of behavior. And for me, I think the key is personally, I can write another book about financial literacy and try more education. But what really I wanted to do was find a way to help people take control of their money by changing the behaviors that they have, whether it's overspending, underspending, panicking, whatever the behavior is. We need to help people find a way to do that. And what I did know for certainty was I didn't have the psychological depth of knowledge to do that on my own. So yeah. I needed to bring in Mark to help.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing the final product. And, we talk to you all the time. We'll get Mark on. We get the psychologist on. Find out why we're so bad at this stuff. I don't know if you've seen a great new movie on Netflix. It's called The Beautiful Game. It stars one of my favorite actors, an old bullet by the name of Bill Nighy. And it's all about something called the Homeless World Cup, something which has never been on my radar, I'm ashamed to say. But it's a great tale about what it means to lose and the role that our characters and personalities play in how we win and how we lose and our behaviors around that. And it's really a fabulous film. If you've got any young person in your life who's hyper-competitive and likes to win, show me any 11-year-old who doesn't, or even a 12-year-old, even older. You should sit down with them and watch this film because it's full of really lovely life lessons. It's also a massively uplifting and inspiring story. But it struck me on that topic, Warren, that we really do need to know how to lose. Whether it's in social media and you're having an argument with somebody and it's win at all costs because, hey, my ego's at play here, or whether it's being, playing a game of golf or playing a game of tennis or playing a paddle or not taking a shortcut on the mountain bike route, or when it comes to money, most crucially, knowing that sometimes you win and sometimes you lose and willing to suck it up when you do, I suppose.
Absolutely right, and to the point, we're hardwired as human beings that when we experience a loss, that loss is far more painful and stays in our memory far longer than the win, when you translate that to kind of a quantity, let's just say you and I start investing and your investment grows by 100 rand. And mine shrinks by 100 rand, you will feel, let's say, one unit of joy, and I will feel at least two units of pain for the same amount of money. And you'll get your joy, and it'll be nice for a period of time, and then you'll forget about it and move on, whereas my pain will stick with me for a long period of time. And when we kind of experience that pain, it burns itself into our memory. And when we then in a situation again in the future where we're faced with a similar sort of a situation, what comes back is the scars from losing. And we say to ourselves, whatever I do, I need to make sure I don't feel that pain again. So I'm going to do something different. I'm going to change. And that's a very good reaction, when you put your finger on the stove because you don't want to burn yourself again. But when it comes to investing and you're investing in the stock market, avoiding the stock market because you don't want to experience the pain of losing some money over a period of time can often be a really bad result. But that's what we do because we have this thing called loss aversion bias, and it kind of rules our lives in a strange way.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because, one can see gains. One watch your stock markets and you see gains of a percentage point today and a half a percentage point tomorrow and 0.75% on Thursday. And suddenly on Friday, the market drops by 2% and you're ahead of where you were on Monday. But you will feel Friday's loss far more than you will feel three subsequent gains of days, which have left you better off week on week. But you feel the loss and go, oh, what a disaster. What a mess. Oh, this market is broken, or whatever the case might be.
Absolutely. And I always think about, investors with tax-free savings accounts. And for some people, a tax-free savings account might be their biggest investment. But there are others for whom a tax-free savings account is small. And if their tax-free saving account is not doing well, the wealthier people, and it represents 5% of their wealth, if that's going badly and 95% of their wealth is going incredibly well, you can guess what they're focusing. It's not the big pot of money that's growing by leaps and bounds. It's the tiniest pot of money in their lives that's not doing well and makes them really grumpy. And that's the point. We just don't get as much joy and as much reward from making money and from doing well with our investments as we do the pain of a loss. And it almost doesn't matter the size, you know, unless it's money that you could almost afford to throw away. Any kind of a loss becomes deeply uncomfortable.
Then. I mean, I'm sure there are billionaires who would be grumpy if they misplaced their wallet with $1,000 in it. You know, not because they have to reapply for their cards like humans, or all of the inconvenience factor, but nobody likes to lose money. And this was, the great work of the late Daniel Kahneman, and we've been refocusing attention on him, of course, the psychologist who won a Nobel Prize for economics, because he pointed out just how irrational we are when it comes to money in particular, and the way in which we respond to loss, which is why I think your point is that you do need to become a good loser. And learning to lose gracefully on the sports field is one thing, but you know, that's a big enough hill to climb for most people. But losing, finding, you know, ways to lose money and being comfortable with that loss, even if you, you know, 10, 15, 20% down in a year, that can really test even the biggest optimist, surely.
It can and will. And so I think you have to focus on this as a skill. I'm by no means saying, you know, turn yourselves into, you know, robots that have no emotion. But what you can do is you can give a context and a framework for making decisions. So, you know, the starting point is to say, you know, one of the real successes, one of the real big keys to becoming a successful investor for the next 10, 20, 30 years is I have to sit in a space psychologically where my portfolio is going to be down 10 or 15% and I need to be really comfortable that's okay. And the reason it's okay is because anytime you buy an investment that has the potential to beat inflation over 5, 10, 20 years, you need to know that if it's a high quality investment, part of that high quality is that it's going to lose you money from time to time. And that's okay. And as soon as you can make that switch as a rational decision before you've put money into your investments, it becomes much easier once markets are down and your emotions kick in. You kind of go back to that framework that you've set for yourself to say, my job here was not to protect my money against a loss over 1 or 2 years. My job was to grow my money by more than inflation over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And if you can get that psychology right before you start investing, and that's a real key point here, you have to try and make yourself comfortable with this before you start. It's pointless, you know, replaying this show as a podcast once you're down 30% and then patting yourself on the back to say everything will be okay. Unfortunately, by then the emotions have kicked in and you're feeling the pain. So preparing yourself before the time for the pain, I guess a bit like your mountain biking person, you know, they know they're going to go up a very long hill and they know they're going to be in a world of pain for a period of time, but they know they peak the hill and then the next one is a downhill and they'll be okay then. And that's the analogy that I'd like to kind of peg for people here is, understand that this is normal. It's good that you feel some losses. It's very constructive because it means you're in an investment which is behaving normally and will give you a good return over time. And maybe it jumps to the second point. Bruce, you can't buy certainty when you want investments to go well. And I woke up this morning and the first thing my wife said to me was, you know, the weather app is telling us there's going to be no rain today. And she was quite happy about that. And then I looked out the window and it was raining. Why is it that weather is such a fantastic topic for all of us, even if we're not farmers, you know, and not gardeners and not living outdoors, we talk about weather and we look at the forecast because we want the certainty. We're actually so desperate for certainty that we will look at the weather app that is grossly unreliable and be happy that something has told us what's going to happen in the next 3 hours, even if we know in our rational brains that it's wrong, most likely to be wrong, because we lack the certainty.
Our human nature demands certainty. That's why people, you know, lots of people have real faith. Other people go to church or another religious gathering just in case. Other people go as an insurance policy because they're not quite sure either way. Some people go to, look for help from, from fortune tellers. Some people read their horoscopes. Absolutely. And everyone's looking for this kind of certainty. There's an entire industry of people who forecast the future inevitably with disastrous results because you cannot predict the thing that is going to come from either left of field or right of field. The thing that's going to get you, the thing that's going to unsettle you, the thing that's going to unseat you is the thing you did not see. Morgan Housel puts it so well in his new book, Same as Ever. And he goes, risk is what you cannot see. And it's just the most wonderful thing because, you can plan everything, guess everything, plot everything. And the big thing that nails you is not going to be anything that you've ever thought was possible or likely.
Exactly right. And I think that we need to be very confident in ourselves to say, I'm going to, at a point in time in my life, be unsettled by something that, that relates to my investments, and I'm going to start looking around for some form of certainty. And the moment you do that, just remind yourself that nobody has certainty. The person that's prognosticating with extreme confidence and real clarity about exactly what's going to happen in the next 12 months, what you need to know is that is a charlatan. That's the person that's selling you a story so that you can give them something. Whatever it is that they're looking for from you, that's why they're prognosticating with that kind of level of confidence. The best advice you're going to get from real brains, and it'd be people like Warren Buffett, will be, gee, I don't know what's going to happen in the next 12 months. I don't know, in fact, what's going to happen in 3 weeks' time. What I do know is there's certain things that you can do from an investment perspective that will almost certainly give you a great outcome. And the two things are, give yourself an enormous amount of time for investing. In other words, don't put your money into high growth investments that will beat inflation over a decade or two, and then expect them to do incredibly well over a 1 or 2 year or 3 year period, because that's very unlikely to happen. In fact, most of the time over a decade, your money will probably be going down. And then all of a sudden, it will shoot up in a big lump and it will give you a great return. And as Bruce says, in a complete surprise. And that's okay. That's how investments work. And the only thing you can do to protect yourself from the uncertainty and from the loss aversion that you're going to experience is just say to yourself, this doesn't matter to me over the next 2 or 3 years. It's uncomfortable to see, but it's a line and a statement. It's not real money that I need today. It's money I need in a long period of time away from now. And if you can do that, what starts to happen is you kind of go out of your emotional brain, your lizard brain, and your rational brain starts to kick in a bit more, and it starts to help you think and process information rather than just feel and react. And feeling and reacting are really healthy when you are on the sports field, or you're trying to avoid a lion, or you're trying not to get burnt in a fire, but very unhealthy when you're making long-term rational decisions.
But you're not making rational decisions. Kahneman told us we're not rational creatures. And here's the point. I mean, if you're trying to make predictions, you know that you will be wrong. I suppose the best you can do is be prepared for things that do go wrong. And so when they do go wrong, you're not surprised. You don't go, oh, I never knew the stock markets could go down. I didn't know interest rates could go up. I didn't know that, bad news would have a negative impact on the amount of money in my portfolio. Be open and honest with yourself is the first step. Thank you, Warren. And I'm really looking forward to your book, by the way. Not a hint or anything. Just dump one on the desk. It's fine. Just put one there. Yeah, absolutely. Now, Gregory sent us an email. And Gregory is doing precisely what we've been talking about this evening, incidentally, trying to predict the future. Gregory says, I'm reading more articles about America's big debt problem. It's not just America's big debt problem, Gregory. It's everybody's big debt problem, and the potential that they will run out of money in the 2030s. How do I invest to protect myself from this catastrophe? Gregory's already predicting a catastrophe. He doesn't know that everybody knows that there is a big debt problem in the world and that some of the smartest brains in the world are already looking at mitigating this particular very obvious risk. Not a criticism of you, Gregory, but I mean, it's just a fact of the world, going back to the point that the things you can see are not the things that are going to get you. But it is a real concern, I think, for many people, Warren, that America's got $35 trillion worth of debt and is signing new blank checks practically every day in order to fund its operations.
It is a concern, and the thing is, it's such a big market that you know, they can control and absorb an enormous amount of debt, far bigger than most other economies, and it won't derail them until one day when it will. And as you say, it will derail them by a complete surprise. It will, you know, it will be something that will set them off and cause the world to fall apart at a moment that no one predicted. So the fact that we are talking about it now, and it's in the 2020s, not the 2030s. You know, this is a problem that might land, you know, in 5 or 15 years time. It is a big problem, and there are lots of brains that are focused on this. The one concern here is it does require something which almost never happens, and it requires politicians to do something difficult. They need to say no to spending more money and to pacifying their voters, and they need to say we're going to start cutting because we are overspending, and we're going to live within our means. And the moment a politician delivers that kind of a message to voters, what usually happens is the politician is no longer in power at the next election. So all sides of the political spectrum in the US will be talking about the debt problem, but no one will actually take the action. And so that's probably the biggest concern, is not that we know the quantum of the issue and we know that we can calculate how long it's going to take for America to run out of money. The truth is, America won't run out of money if people believe that the American country can still repay its debts. It will run out of money the day everybody else outside of America believes that America can't pay the debt anymore. And that will be a complete surprise to everyone that day when it happens. So if you're in this position, Gregory, and you're worrying about something a decade away, what I would say to you is, by then we'll probably have something much more worrying or much more concerning to worry about. And this will be a problem that's been managed. And so understand that there will always be reasons to be fearful. And yes, you shouldn't trust politicians to do the sensible, logical, common sense thing. But gee, to start worrying now about something that might happen in a decade's time, I don't think it makes sense. So my answer is, stick to normal investment principles, you know, have proper diversification of your investments across, you know, geographies, across different asset classes. Try not to make very big decisions based on what you think is going to happen. You know, sensible diversification protects you from things that are going to go really wrong that no one predicted. And that means that sometimes you have investments that go well, that are surprising, and sometimes you have investments that go badly that are surprising. But overall, you'll do reasonably well most of the time. And all the prognosticators who will be living in either ecstasy or fear based on what they think is going to happen, they will have a very tough time, and you'll be okay, Gregory. And you can listen to these conversations where people are telling you about how the world's going to end, and maybe they're right. You know, we don't know, but the truth is, people that have ignored the prognosticators and stuck to a strategy and, you know, had a sensible diversification strategy and had a long-term focus, they've tended to do a lot better than everybody else, including the prognosticators who have to talk to survive.
There are many thousands of reasons, Warren, to not take action. And that's really the problem. You can talk yourself out of, you know, doing stuff because, you know, you see a scary monster under every single bush. And yes, there are lots of scary monsters. But in the fullness of time, the rules of investing to date have held up fairly well, I would argue.
Over centuries. And the reason is that eventually markets are driven by human beings, and it's very difficult, as we've discussed, for human beings to stay sensible and rational. So the people that can find a way to stay invested over long periods of time tend to do incredibly well. Not because they're geniuses and not because they're, you know, they're sociopaths with no emotions, but just because they find a way to force themselves to stick to some kind of a long-term strategy and then ride it out no matter what's going on. And it's amazing to look back at their success because everyone else who couldn't do that, you know, ends up nowhere. And the few that do become famous investors, and we write books about them, and we talk about them, and we put them on pedestals. And that's great. That it's worth doing. But they weren't that bright, and they'll tell you that themselves. They weren't geniuses. They just found a way to stick it out. And that's the answer. Stick it out, Gregory.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital. Thanks, Warren.